Okay, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I have muted everybody because there was some background noise, but it's a pleasure to be learning together today. My name is Rabbi Ari Zucker from the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel of Chicago, and we're very excited to be learning together in this format. And so, God willing, at the end, I'll unmute, and anyone who has questions or comments, I'm happy to stick around and to hear. But for the time being, let us embark on our study of Parshat Bahalutcha. I'm very excited to share with you a thought that I had last year that I've been gradually developing, and I happen to think that it's fascinating, and I hope you'll feel the same way. The thought goes as follows. When we look at Moshe Rabbeinu, when we look at Moshe as our leader of Bnei Israel, we see a man who, I would argue, generally, his affect, his demeanor is cool, calm, collected. And this is the man who went head-to-head with the most powerful man in the world. He went head-to-head with Paro, the king of Egypt. And he took the Jewish people out of Egypt, even though that had never been accomplished before. Moshe Rabbeinu's got it. But if that wasn't enough, Moshe Rabbeinu not only takes the Jewish people out of Egypt, not only brings 10 plagues upon the Egyptians, but Moshe leads the Jewish people through the Red Sea without blinking. Moshe Rabbeinu accepts the Torah on Har Sinai. And then, perhaps most impressive of all for Moshe, he goes head-to-head, Kaviyachol, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Because in Parshas Ki Tisa, God says, I want to destroy the Jewish people. And Moshe does the unthinkable. Moshe argues with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I would have thought, you might have thought, that if God tells you to do something, you say, okay. This is the Ribono Shel Olam. How could you possibly say no to God? And so God is telling Moshe Rabbeinu that the Jewish people have sinned, and God wants to wipe them out, and that they're not going to be around anymore. God is going to rebuild the Jewish people through Moshe. And instead of Moshe agreeing, instead of Moshe saying, well, you know, you're HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know better than I, Moshe instead says, no, not happening. Moshe blatantly and almost potentially, flagrantly, you could argue it's inappropriate. Moshe says no to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He rejects it, he refuses. And to the extent that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Moshe, I'm going to rebuild the Jewish people just with you and your children. And Moshe says, if you wipe out the Jewish people, I want you to wipe out me as well. So Moshe is not, he's not a lightweight. He's a heavy hitter. Moshe can stand up when it's necessary. Moshe is confident. Moshe is safe. He's secure. Moshe is, I guess we might call in Hebrew, he's a gavra. He's a man. And yet, there are a few times where Moshe doesn't seem to be cool, calm, and collected. Where Moshe, forgive the term, Moshe freaks out. He flips out. Moshe doesn't seem to be the impressive man of stature that we're used to seeing him. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at a few of those episodes and try and understand what's going on in those episodes that leads Moshe to sort of drop his austere, his impressive, not to say facade, but where Moshe's no longer looking as impressive as he is. Where we see Moshe as maybe more of a man than he usually is. And I think that it starts in our Parsha. If you look at our Parsha, Bahalutcha is a fascinating Parsha. Also, Rav Soloveitchik described it as a very sad Parsha. Bahalutcha, in addition to having lots of things going on in it, it's a sad story, because if you think about the trajectory of the Jewish people until now, we were slaves in Egypt, and through the 10 plagues, through the splitting of the sea, we left Egypt, and we arrived at Har Sinai. We arrived and received the Torah on Mount Sinai, and then we messed up a little bit. We faltered, and with the sin of the golden calf, and yet we made it back. We did better, and we were on our way. And we built the Mishkan, we built the tabernacle, and Bahalutcha comes after the building of the tabernacle, after Chet Ego, now that the Jewish people are set up in their encampments, we know how many people are in the nation, and Baalotzka starts out counting the Levium and inaugurating the Levium to serve in the Mishkan, and then talks about the traveling of the Jewish people. We are traveling. We are on our way. Where are we going? Moshe tells Yisrael, we are going to Eretz Yisrael. Moshe has the end in sight. He is so excited. He is expecting that he and his children and his family and the Jewish people are all going to settle in the land of Israel and effectively live happily ever after. And not only are they going to Israel, but we have the Jewish people who are so committed, so connected to Torah, to mitzvah, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that in the beginning of the third Aliyah and in the ninth chapter of Baalotzka, we learn about the Pesach Sheni. The Pesach Sheni is this beautiful story of people who were not able to bring the Korban Pesach the month prior, and they say, Lama Nigara, why should we miss out? We don't want to miss out on doing mitzvot. How beautiful for the Jewish people to approach Moshe and say, not only do we like doing mitzvot, not only are we trying to learn Torah, not only do we want to be connected to a Kadosh Baruch Hu and to our nation, but if we miss out on one of those opportunities, we're going to look for a loophole to figure out a way that I can do more mitzvot. How often are people trying to get out of their obligations, and now the Jewish people are trying to get into those obligations? Beautiful, inspiring. This is a wonderful picture of the Jewish people. And yet, we know what happens next. We know that the Jewish people are not going to be perfect. And Parshat Baalotzka has the most stylistically unique parsha in the entire Torah, because there are parts of the Torah where there's more spacing going on. If you look at Az Yashir and you look at Ha'azinu, there are columns that are set up in different ways than usual. But in Baalotzka, at the beginning of the sixth Aliyah, we have the case of the upside down Nunim. The letter Nun, in two instances, it's upside down, bracketing the psukim, the verses of Vayhi bin Sar Aharon and Ubnu Koyomar, the two things that we say when we take out the Torah and when we return the Torah in our davening today. And there's a discussion that these are really breaking off the Vayhi bin Sar, these two lines, into a separate book. And even though we will commonly say that there are five books of the Torah, five books of Moses, there are in fact seven. And it's the first half of Sefer Bamidbar, and these 85 letters, these two lines, and then the second half of Sefer Bamidbar. But even if we don't think about it, about our parsha as being part of three different Sfarim, there's a clear demarcation happening here, a clear split, a clear change from what happened before the upside-down bracketing Nuns and what happens after. And if we pay attention, that's where we see a big difference in the affect and in the demeanor of our Moshe Rabbeinu. So we got to look and try and figure out what happened here. What's happening before these Nunim that leads to after the Nunim? Because the Rav points out that after the Nunim, the Rav Soloveitchik used to say, things really go downhill. The way I think about it is that the Jewish people are really ascending, as we described. They're going up and up and up, and they're about to arrive at the ultimate ascent. They're going to quite literally make Aliyah. They're going to go up, and they're going to reach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're going to be living in the land of Israel. And yet these Nunim happen, and then we just have mistake and downfall after downfall. Next week, I apologize for ruining what's coming, but next week the Jewish people are going to be on the precipice of the land of Israel, and yet they will not enter, because instead they send the Meraglim, they send the spies, and this generation will eventually die out in the desert. So what starts this whole process? I think it's something seemingly innocuous, seeming that we would never imagine, but something that I hope to argue today is actually amongst the most significant things that happens in our Sefer, that happens in the entire Torah even, and in the history of the Jewish people. We see that right before this, before these bracketing Nuns, there's a conversation between Moshe and his father-in-law with Chovav, whom we often call Yitro. And in that conversation, Yitro is ready to leave. Yitro, he was there for the receiving of the Torah. He's seen the construction of the Mishkan. He you know, gave his 2 cents here and there, and now Yisro is ready to leave. And Moshe is talking to his father-in-law and begging him not to leave. And we're going to appreciate that conversation a little bit more. But for the time being, we just know that the only thing that seems to happen before these Nunim are Yitro leaving and then the Jewish people traveling. So the Jewish people traveling seemingly doesn't seem so significant. The only real change that's taking place is that Yitro leaves. And so in order to appreciate the significance of Yitro leaving, we're going to take a look at the relationship between Moshe and Yitro. And who is this man Yitro? So we meet Yitro in Parshat Shemot. Moshe Rabbeinu is running away from Egypt because he killed an Egyptian man. And Yitro, who is the Kohen Minyan, he is the leader. He is the head of the nation of Minyan. He effectively takes Moshe in. And he supports him, and he gives him a job, and he gives him a wife. And this might be a silly question, and I'll take the hit if it is a silly question, but that's okay. We know that Moshe grows up in the palace. We know that he grows up as Paro's, I guess you could say, adopted grandson. That Paro's daughter, Batya, finds Moshe and adopts him. And so Moshe is Paro's grandson. And when Moshe's 40 years old, he kills this Egyptian. He runs off. 40 years later, he comes back. And Moshe's just like walking around. And at no point in time is there ever a conversation between Moshe and Paro. Paro never says, hey, wait a second, you're this Jewish man who's trying to take my slaves away from me, he looks really familiar. And Paro doesn't like take out the photo album, he doesn't look back in the photos in his iPhotos and say, wait a second, this guy looks just like Moshe. Do you remember Moshe, that kid that we found, he grew up in the palace, and then he just disappeared one day? Where is that Moshe guy? And seemingly for some reason, Paro never puts two and two together that this same Moshe that he raised is the one who's now trying to take his slaves from him. And I guess maybe this is best illuminated in the movie Prince of Egypt, which I still think is, albeit not all the details are exactly as it is written in the text, in order to get the feeling of what it was like for the Jewish people to leave, I highly recommend watching The Prince of Egypt. In The Prince of Egypt, Pharaoh and Moses are brothers. And Moses goes off, and Moses comes back, and their father had died, and now Moses' brother Ramses is the prince of is now the king of Egypt, and so Moses is literally going up against his brother, and there's a tension that exists in the movie, and I wonder if that tension existed in the actual story, in the way it exists, and the way it's presented in Chumash. We see no connection between Moshe as a family member of Paro, and yet I would assume that there's something there. And so, because the text doesn't tell us anything about it, I want to suggest that maybe Moshe wasn't really so close with his grandfather. Maybe Moshe was maybe relegated. Moshe didn't have much to do with the royal family. He was adopted. He was the chesed case. He was the charity case. One of the daughters of Paro, of Batya. But Moshe was not, as DreamWorks calls him, the Prince of Egypt. Moshe had no connection with the family. Moshe was just this, random kid. And so if that's the case, then Moshe never really had a father figure. We know that Amram and Yocheved were his parents, and Yocheved became his wet nurse, and she was involved in raising him in some way, shape, or form. But as a father figure, we're not really aware of Amram having anything to do with his son Moshe. And so I wonder, did Moshe not really have a father until he meets Yisro? And maybe, for 40 years, he's got a mother figure he's taken care of. He's got all the things he needs. And maybe he's got a butler named Alfred Pennyworth who's taking care of him and guiding him and helping him grow up. But he doesn't have a real father figure, someone to take him in, to support him, to train him, to give him guidance. And I wonder if Yisro becomes that person. And what I'm going to suggest is that Yisro actually takes a very significant role in Moshe's life. Because starts out, and Yisro is sort of filling in this father figure role. And then, if you look in Parshat Shemot, Moshe Rabbeinu is offered the job of being the leader, the manhig of the Jewish people. He's going to, told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he's going to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, he's not so sure he wants to do it. Eventually God convinces him. And the very next thing that Moshe does literally goes from talking to God to the very next thing the Torah tells us Moshe does is he goes and talks to his father-in-law. He goes and counsels with Yisro. So Kodesh Baruch Hu convinced him, but perhaps Moshe doesn't really sign on. Moshe is not really confident in this endeavor until he talks to Yisro, and Yisro tells him, you know, Lech L'Shalom, you know, go in peace. You're going to be good at this. You've got this, my son-in-law. And the language that the Pasuk uses, I think, is very specific. You know, Vayelech Moshe Vayeshev al Yisro Chosno. He goes and he settles with Yisro. Not just that he settled with him, but he settled with Yisro, his father-in-law. He went to his confidant, his support. And sure enough, Yisro tells him, Lech L'Shalom, you should go. This is going to be great. This is a good opportunity for you. Moshe is effectively given a job offer, and his father-in-law agrees that it is a good opportunity for Moshe. And actually, if you track it, Moshe Rabbeinu does generally maintain that even keel, that cool, calm, and collected demeanor, except there are a couple times throughout the Makot, particularly in the beginning, where Moshe doesn't seem as confident. And HaKadosh Baruch himself is the one who supports him and encourages him, and Moshe needs reassurance, perhaps because Moshe doesn't have that support in the form of his father-in-law, in the form of Yisro. Now let's take it one step further, because maybe Moshe Rabbeinu has a father-in-law, a father figure in Yisro. But okay, so he's his father figure. Great, so they can have Thanksgiving together. But if we look at the beginning of Parsha Yitro, the Parsha named for such a man, Parsha Yitro starts out and Moshe goes and greets his father-in-law, and that's a big kavod. But okay, lots of people greet their fathers-in-law. What's so special about it? But then we see Moshe, who is gearing up for Matan Torah. He sets everything aside, he turns off his phone, he locks the door, and he's just sitting one-on-one, schmoozing with his father-in-law. And we see a whole back and forth between them, and clearly Moshe is very excited to have them, and Yisro is so happy, Yisro decides he's going to convert to the Jewish people. And then in the second Aliyah of Parsha Yitro, we see Yitro give Moshe Rabbeinu advice. Moshe is running a court system that doesn't seem to be very effective, where everyone has to talk to Moshe himself whenever anything comes up. And Yisro suggests basically a Supreme Court, circuit court setup, where there'll be judges of 50s, 10s and 50s and 100s and thousands, and eventually the hard cases will find their way up to Moshe Rabbeinu. But you can have other people sort of filling in the gaps. And so first of all, Eli Leibowitz, a Chicago native, likes to say that, when you look at this instance of Yisro giving advice, you could be Moshe Rabbeinu. You could bring 10 plagues on the land of Egypt. You could pass the Jewish people through the sea on dry land. And even still, with all that accomplishment, your father-in-law is still going to come around and correct you. So even though we're muted, I know that everyone was laughing. Wonderful. Yisro comes and gives Moshe advice. And I wonder if what we're seeing here is that Moshe Rabbeinu is sort of taking the leadership role in the Jewish people. He is leading them out of Egypt. He's leading them to the land of Israel. And God is guiding him. God is the one who's telling him what to do. He is God's man. He is Eved Hashem. And yet, at the day-to-day intricacies of being a leader, I don't know that God was like, reading business books with Moshe and giving him pointers on do this and do that. Moshe wasn't a mindless robot. Moshe was serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Moshe had the same free will, but he also meant that he had the same wonder. He had the same gaps in understanding that everyone else did, everyone else does. And Moshe had to figure it out on his own sometimes. The Ramban actually says that at the end of in Parsha Peshalach, in the context of Kriyat Yamsuf, that Moshe davens to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "Why are you davening to me? Go do something." And the Ramban says that this is the first time that Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't know what he's supposed to do. Until that point, for the year of taking the Jewish people out of Egypt, the year of the plagues, every single action of Moshe was dictated. Moshe Rabbeinu had a script that he followed word for word, and that was it. But once they've left the land of Egypt, now that the Jewish people are traveling through the desert, Moshe is a little bit more independent. Moshe doesn't have as much support. And maybe, just maybe, Moshe doesn't really know exactly what he's supposed to do. But his father-in-law, who is a former head of state, he was the Kohen Midian, his father-in-law says, hey, Moshe, I have an idea. And maybe they sit down in the Oval Office and, you know, they've each got a cup of coffee and they're just talking about leadership. And Yisro makes a suggestion about how to structure the court system of the Jewish people. And we don't hear much else about Yitro until our parsha, until Parsha Pa'alotcha, when Yisro's finally leaving. But Moshe Rabbeinu's request for Yitro to stay is very powerful. He's saying, you know, don't leave us. I'll just read the English in the art scroll. He says, please, do not forsake us. That's not a polite, jovial, that's not just the common courtesy, cordial way to say your father-in-law, oh, please don't go, it's so nice having you. Moshe, I would suggest, is begging his father-in-law, please don't leave me. You're my confidant. You're my consultant. You're the person that I turn to for help. And yet Yisro says, I got to go. It's time for me to leave. You'll be okay. And because Yisro can see the Jewish people are fine. Yisro probably thinks he's leaving his son-in-law off to go to Israel because they're on a straight route. They're about to go. They're ready to be in this land of Israel. Yisro no longer needs to mentor or to guide his son-in-law Moshe. And yet, Yisro leaves. We have these parenthetical nunim talking about Vayibitzar Aaron. And then we have, in the beginning of the 11th parak of Sefer Bamidbar and Parsha Pa'alotcha, we have this case of the Midonanim. And the Midonanim, basically, these are people who were seemingly looking to complain. They're complaining that they had great food in Egypt, they don't have good food now, which is amongst the most absurd complaints you could ever make, because in all likelihood in Egypt they didn't have very good food, and even if they had the best food in Egypt, they're literally eating man every single day. The manna that fell from heaven, that fell at their door, could taste like anything. There was no waste. Forget all the flavors in the world. You never have to go to the bathroom. And maybe that's why they were complaining. Maybe they wanted, you know, to have a bathroom break. Maybe there were some really good books that they didn't have a chance to read unless they were going to the bathroom. But the man was the greatest food of all time. When the man fell, you said, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Hamotzi Lechem, Min HaShamayim. You were eating God food. And yet the Jewish people are complaining. And this complaint leads Moshe to turn to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and if I may say so, with all kavod to Moshe Rabbeinu Eved Hashem, he flips out. And he says, reading in the art scroll on page 789, why have you done evil to your servant? Why have I not found favor in your eyes? Why do you place the burden of the entire people on me? Moshe's like, I can't handle this. The Jewish people are so much to carry. It's too much. I can't do it. I didn't give birth to them. I'm not their mother. And he says in verse 14, I alone cannot carry this entire nation, for it is too heavy for me. And if this is how you deal with me, then kill me now, if I have found favor in your eyes, and let me not see my evil. Moshe says, I cannot be the leader of the Jewish people. It's too much for me. And he says, I'd rather die. This, with all kavod to Moshe, I think is what we call a freak out. Because just two pages prior in our Chumash, less than 20 lines prior, he's talking to Yisro about how they're going to Israel, how this is going to be wonderful and great and perfect. And Moshe can see the finish line. Moshe's so excited. And all of a sudden, Moshe is falling apart. And Moshe's depressed. Moshe's asking to die. What's changing so very much? It's the fact that he doesn't have Yisro anymore. I think not having Yisro really, really eats him apart. And it goes further than that, because the rest of this parsha really is not so good. You know, we have this instance of bringing in new prophets, and now there are 70 new prophets in the nation, because Moshe says, I can't do it all, and so God says, okay, I'll give you a little bit of support, I'll give you 70 prophets, and two of those prophets are named Eldad and Medad, and they start prophesizing in the camp, and they prophesize, Rashi tells us, that Moshe is going to die, and Yeshua is going to lead them into the promised land. Yeshua, the Na'ar, the boy, Moshe's right-hand man, Yeshua is going to lead them into Israel. Right here, we find out for the first time that Moshe's vision of the finish line, Moshe's long-term goal, Moshe's dream of being in Israel, might not happen. Moshe might not be able to lead them in. And it all started right here. It all started with Yisro leaving and with him falling apart, with Moshe saying that he can't carry the Jewish people anymore. And Joshua, runs to Moshe and he says, Moshe, Eldad and Medad are prophesizing that you are going to die. They're prophesizing. Only you are supposed to be a prophet. And Moshe says to him, in verse 29, again in the Art Scroll, on page 793 this time, Moshe said to him, are you being zealous for my sake? Would that the entire people of Hashem could be prophets, if Hashem would but place his spirit upon them. Moshe says to Yeshua, what are you upset about? I don't want to be leader. I don't want to be in charge. I want everyone else to be able to talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm not interested in this job anymore. And Moshe seemingly is done. And then, at the end of Parshat Baaloska, the unthinkable happens. And we said that the unthinkable happened before, but this is seemingly even worse. Moshe lost his companion, his comrade, his support, his consultant. He lost Yisro. And now, the other two people who we might have imagined would be the place he would turn to for support are gossiping about him. Miriam and Aaron are talking about Moshe and what's going on in his family life because Moshe is no longer spending time with his wife. And Miriam says, that's terrible. How could Moshe not be living with his wife anymore? Aaron, you're a prophet. Me, Miriam, I'm a prophetess. And we're still living with our spouses. Why is it Moshe doing the same? And so that episode results in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and God yelling at them, berating them, and explaining to them that Moshe actually is on a different level entirely. Moshe is unequivocal to any other prophet. Moshe spoke to God face to face. But the question I'm wondering is, why is Miriam asking questions about Moshe Rabbeinu? Similarly, Moshe hasn't been with his wife Tzipora in a long time, since he started prophesizing, seemingly he wouldn't have been with Tzipora. His prophecy has been exceptional for a long time. Moshe moved his tent outside of the camp. Moshe's been separate. Moshe's been different for a while. Why now is Miriam asking questions about Moshe? So here's what I think. This is what I want to suggest. I have not seen anything to back it up, but I think it's Amos Le'amito. I think this is the truth. I think that when Moshe freaks out, when Moshe, makes his exclamation to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and for sure to Yehoshua, I think Miriam and Aaron see it. I think Miriam sees that Moshe, her younger brother, but who's not really her younger brother, Moshe Rabbeinu and Miriam never really met. They don't speak at any point in the entire Torah. We have no clue that they ever had any conversations. We know that Miriam looked out for Moshe as a child to make sure that he was okay, and ultimately led to him going down the river and finding himself with Bat Paro. And we know that when Moshe led the men in song after the splitting of the sea, that Miriam led the women in song. But we don't actually know that they ever spoke, that there was any relationship between this brother and sister, between Moshe and Miriam. And so what I'd like to suggest is that, Miriam only kind of re-met Moshe 2 years ago, and the relationship wasn't really going. We don't know that much about the relationship. I would argue that Miriam didn't really know Moshe. She wasn't really so familiar with him. She looked at Moshe as being this larger-than-life figure, this man who talked to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who took the Jewish people out of Egypt, who received the Torah, this larger-than-life Moshe, who was not just a man, who was so much more than a man, who was incredible. And then she sees Moshe have a breakdown. She sees Moshe freak out about being unable to lead the Jewish people, that he doesn't really want to be a prophet. And this idea starts to creep into Miriam's mind that maybe Moshe is just a guy. He's a man just like me. He's special. He's exceptional. But he's no different than me. He's no different than my brother Aaron. And so she said, with that notion, she turns to her brother Aaron and says, hey, Moshe's just like us. Why isn't he acting like us? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to say, Miriam, you got to understand, Moshe's not really like you. However, if we look at that episode, the sixth, the third verse of the 20 of the 12th chapter, Perek Yudbet Pasuk Gimel, tells us that, you know, there was the conversation between Miriam and her brother, and then V'ha'ish Moshe Anav Me'od Mikol Ha'adam Asher Al Pnei Ha'adamah. Moshe was the most humble man to ever live, but it says Moshe Ha'ish. Moshe was a man. He was just a regular guy. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu proceeds to chastise him that he's special, and that he's, you know, unequivocally different. There's no way that he could be compared to the rest of them. It's the rest of prophets, and that he talks to God face to face, and he's Moshe Avdi. But this whole episode starts. This whole description of Moshe as being so special starts with Moshe Ha'ish. And maybe Moshe was special, but Moshe was still a ish. Moshe was still a man. He was still just a guy. And he still needed help, he still needed support, still needed love. And his father-in-law, Yisro, was no longer around to back him up, to support him, to help him. And we're going to look at one more story about Moshe Rabbeinu. We're going to look at the beginning of Parshat Chukat. Because at the beginning of Parshat Chukat, Miriam passes away. We lose Miriam, the female leader of the Jewish people, but also the sister of Moshe and Aaron. And we know what ultimately ensues, that Parsha Chukat is the Parsha in which Moshe Rabbeinu is told that he's going to die, that he will no longer be the leader of the Jewish people. But where does it all come from? Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen are sitting Shiva. This is based on the Al-Sheikh, but in Parsha Chukat, they're sitting Shiva for Miriam. And because Miriam had died, the water that all the Jewish people had access to in the schus of Miriam, it had dried up because Miriam was no longer alive. So Moshe and Aaron are sitting Shiva. They're sitting on, maybe they're like low armrest chairs, maybe they were just sitting on like milk crates at the time, you know, back in the day before they came up with the idea of having nice leather chairs. And so Moshe and Aaron are sitting there, and they're mourning for their sister, and they're crying. And they see off in the distance the whole congregation coming toward them. And Aaron HaKohen says, "Oh, that's so beautiful. Look, they're coming to comfort us." And Moshe Rabbeinu says, "No, my brother, they're not coming to comfort us. They're coming because they're upset about something." And sure enough, they come and they complain and they yell that they don't have any water. And Moshe and Aaron, they get up, and Moshe ends up yelling at the Jewish people. He loses it, seemingly, again. And he makes a mistake. And he and Aaron are punished. And they're not able to go into the land of Israel. And I wonder if in this 38-year period between Parsha Pa'alucha and Parsha Chukat, if that we don't hear any outbreaks from Moshe, we don't really hear much about the story of the Jewish people at all. But I wonder if after this incident where God tells Miriam and Aaron that Moshe's special and he's uncomparable to anyone else, but also says Moshe's a man, maybe Miriam and Aaron realize that Moshe, while being very different than the rest of them, he's also a lot more like them than they may have realized. He's also a man, and he needs help, he needs support. And maybe if over the course of those 38 years, Miriam becomes that support. Miriam, who started out Moshe's life as a support for him. Miriam, who looked out for him as he traveled down the river, who actually was really the reason why he was born in the first place. Miriam was Moshe's go-to. And once Yisro leaves, once Yisro is no longer there to support him, Moshe turns to his siblings, and he develops a close relationship. And the children of Amram and Yocheved become very, very close. They become a wonderful family. And so when they lose Miriam, when Moshe loses his sister, once again, he's having difficulty, he's struggling to the extent that he lashes out at the Jewish people. And all this is really coming to share a suggestion that I had in the world of sports. Everything we learned today really, it was all for the sake of me being able to tell you something from the year 2014. Because in the year 2014, the MVP for the National Football League, I actually don't even remember who it was, insignificant. But I can tell you who the MVP of the National Football League should have been. Now, what is an MVP? An MVP is the most valuable player. A most valuable player means that the person for whom the team could not do without. That's what value means. Not the person who gets paid the most, not the person who performed better than everyone else. Most valuable player literally means the person who, for whom the team could not function without. And in the year 2014, the quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts was named Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning spent the previous 12 seasons, from his rookie season all the way until 2014, leading his team to the playoffs every single year. The Colts were always a force to be reckoned with. They were always a playoff-worthy team. They won a couple they won the championship once. They went to the conference finals many times. The Colts were a wonderful, impressive, force to be reckoned with team in the National Football League. But in the year 2014, Peyton Manning was injured, and he didn't play the entire season. And in that year, the Colts, instead of always, say, going 10-6, of always having a win percentage that's greater than 50%, they went 2-14. They were the worst team in the NFL that year. And that year, I don't even remember who won the MVP, but I can tell you unequivocally that who should have won the MVP? It should have been Peyton Manning. Because if Peyton Manning had not been playing, because when Peyton Manning was not playing for the Indianapolis Colts, the team was terrible. They were awful. They were pathetic. And when he was playing for them, they were incredible. They were amazing. They were formidable. Which leads us to understand that the most valuable player in the 2014 NFL season was unequivocally, without question, Peyton Manning. I don't know who the most valuable player in Chumash is. But what we've looked at today is that the role that Yitro played in the life of Moshe Rabbeinu and the ramifications of Moshe's lack of support when Yitro leaves and ultimately when Miriam leaves. That Moshe finds out that he's not going into Israel right after he loses the support of his confidant, of his companion, of his consultant, of his father-in-law, of Yitro. And Moshe's nail in the coffin, where Moshe has decided that he is going to die, is right after he loses his second support. He loses Miriam 38 years later. And in the world that we live in today, oftentimes the term MVP is given to the person who shines the most, the person who scores the most baskets, who wins the most games. But MVP does not mean that you are the most talented, the best, the person in the spotlight. MVP means who is the most valuable, the most essential person here. Maybe the most essential person in our story is not Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe the most essential person in our story is the people who are supporting Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu would not be able to perform the way that he did for the Jewish people during his 40-year journey without those people who are guiding him, who are supporting him. The greatest praise perhaps you could ever give somebody is to be an Ozer. To be a helper. We describe a Kadosh Baruch Hu in our first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei as being Melech Ozer Moshe Omagen. You're the king and you are the helper. And you're a protector and you're a redeemer. But in Kadosh Baruch Hu, you're a helper. Adam begins his journey in the world. First man, and God says, I'm going to create for you an Ezer Kenegdo. I'm going to create for you a helper opposite you. And some might look at that and say, oh my gosh, how terrible that Chava is created only to help Adam. But maybe Adam really is worthless. What a Kadosh Baruch Hu is effectively saying is that Adam, you don't measure up to much. You're not really very worthwhile. You're not even really worth creating on your own. Only when you have an Ezer Kenegdo, only when you have someone opposite you, someone who's helping you and supporting you, who's getting you to where you need to be, only then are you of value. Meaning that without Chava as playing her role as Ezer Kenegdo, Adam never would have existed. In the world today, we spend too much time looking at the person in the limelight, when maybe we should spend a little bit more time looking at the Azer behind the scenes, the person who's really making it happen. The phrase that everybody likes to say is that behind every successful man is a much more impressive woman. And we joke about it, and we'll say it at anniversary parties, but I think just we see here, it's not necessarily husband-wife, but it's the people who are there when the leader can loosen his tie, can take a load off, can just talk and feel supported. Not even necessarily to give incredible advice. Yisro's advice to Moshe Rabbeinu seemingly was not so impressive. Oh, you know, you should probably break down this system so that you're not working all day. Moshe probably would have figured that out eventually. The godless, the greatness of Yisro was not the depth of his perception, not his tremendous insight. It was just the fact that he was someone Moshe could turn to, or Moshe could drop the leader position, not to say facade, because that would imply that he wasn't genuinely leader, but he could drop the leader voice, and he could just be himself, he could relax. And how many times do we have the opportunity to support someone else it doesn't excite us, it doesn't make us feel so special, because we want to be in the limelight. But I think Baloska and Yisro and Miriam are showing us that it's not necessary. You can just be a support. And I guess I'll close with something that I'm learning on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock on the Kol's Facebook page regarding Shabbos. We're learning the Sefer called Shabbos Makasa, all about the Shabbos Queen, written by Rav Shimshon David Pinkus Zasal. And in it, right now what we're learning about is the idea of Malchus. Malchus of kingship. Malchus is no attribute of its own. Someone who's a king might not have an agenda. What Malchus is, the description of that midah, of that attribute of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, is the taking the potential that exists within a person, within an entity, and making it come to life. The role of Yisro, the role of Miriam, the role of that Ezer Kenegdo, is effectively to be the Malchus, to be that which allows the potential within something to come to fruition, to come to life, to take act, to become, go from the potential to the kinetic, to the actual. It's a tremendous opportunity for us to not shine in the limelight, but in fact, to be that Ezer Kenegdo, to be that support, to be that Yisro, that each and every one of the tremendous leaders that we're surrounded with really genuinely need. I hope that that was inspiring. I hope that a lesson that doesn't push us to strive to be the best, but to strive us to do what's actually most valuable. And then we all can be a real MVP, a real most valuable player.